You'll see from the title of the notes this evening that in the basic Bible study that we have, we are taking part two, and that is the geography of the Old Testament. The geography of the Old Testament. Now, I don't know about you, geography may not have been your favourite subject at school. It kind of appears to be one of mine because I took it to A-level and did an A-level in it, and then probably have left it all behind and forgotten about it ever since. But I quite liked it when I was at school. Other people see no need for it and see no value in it whatsoever. Well, we trust tonight as we look through the geography of the Old Testament that there will be something that's of relevance to us, and something that maybe when we're least expecting it and reading again in the Bible, something will crop up and we'll think, ah, that appeared in those Bible study notes that night. I must get them out again and have a look through them. I believe it is important to understand the size and the situation of things, the distances between them, because when we understand the distance between certain features that we read of in the Bible, only then we will get a sense of scale and a proper perspective. In other words, what I'm saying is, as appears in the first page, a knowledge of geography can give us tremendous help visualizing and understanding the events that we read of in the Bible. It is helpful to know the names, the locations, the distances between important geographical locations. Otherwise, we'll come to the Word of God and we'll pitch into, say, for example, 1 Samuel, that has a lot of geographical details in it, and we'll skim over the information that's given there without picturing it, visualizing it, or understanding it, and therefore the Bible will be less interesting and will be less easily understood. If we don't know geography, we cannot really know history. And the Bible, of course, is a book that is largely to do with history. You'll remember the notes that we had last week, and the first 17 books of the Old Testament, that was the historical section, and the first 5 books in the New Testament, that was the historical section in the New Testament. So, out of 66 books in its entirety, we have there 22, one-third of all of the books have to do with history. The Bible is largely history. So, to begin mastering the history that is in the Bible, we need to start with the geography of the Bible. Now, it is interesting to consider this fact. All of the lands that we read of in the Bible, whether we're talking about Israel, or we're moving north into Babylonia, or we're talking about moving right over to the right-hand side, is going to be east, and we're into Persia, and Babylonia, and all of those names, all of the area that's talked about in Scripture, in the Old Testament world, it fits into one state in the United States of America. And that state is its second largest, which is the state of Texas. Over, of course, in America, Alaska, with its wasteland, etc., would be the largest state. The second largest is Texas, which I'm told is round about 695,622 square kilometres. But the entire lands of the Old Testament would fit into this state of Texas. In other words, if we were talking to an American audience tonight, and particularly those that came from Texas, we could say, if you were to travel from the Persian Gulf to Israel, it would in Texas be like going from Houston to Odessa. If you were traveling in Bible times from Israel down into the land of Egypt, well, if you were in Texas, that would be like going from Odessa to El Paso, all within the one American state. Now, if we keep this fact in mind, as the story of the Bible unfolds, it will help us keep some geographical perspective. We are not, in other words, talking about a massive region when we consider the lands of the Bible. We have the title there, Bodies of Water, and we say that the primary anchor points for mastering the geography of the Bible are the bodies of water. These are the marker cones, in other words, and everything else we can talk about with reference to these. So, the bodies of water that are there in Bible lands, they're pretty good for us when we come to consider the geography of the place. First of all, we'll talk about the Mediterranean Sea, otherwise called the Great Sea. The land of the Old Testament lies to the east of what is this beautiful blue body of water, the Mediterranean. We have, and we meet it many times in the Word of God, the Sea of Galilee. Although they call this body of water the Sea of Galilee, is a bit of an overstatement. It's really a large freshwater lake up in northern Israel. It is only 7 miles wide, and it's 14 miles long. If you're moving in the Mediterranean over to the Sea of Galilee, you'll only have traveled from the coast of the Mediterranean there 36 miles until you come to the Sea of Galilee. Now, Galilee has a very unique feature in that it lies almost 700 feet. That's 215 meters below sea level. And away down there in a little basin, that is one of the reasons why the Sea of Galilee is liable to sudden fierce storms, as the wind funnels through the hills that surround it. And so it comes as no surprise when, for example, we come into the New Testament and we find Jesus and the disciples on the lake, the Sea of Galilee, and the storm hits in. And it's a fierce and a vigorous storm. Storms were pretty typical in this area. And the reason being, because it was lying so far below sea level and subjected to great winds. While the lake is a focal point in the gospel stories, and it seems that many of our Lord's teachings and many of his miracles were done around the borders of the Sea of Galilee, while it figures therefore prominently in the New Testament, it's only the region of Galilee, not the Sea of Galilee, but the region of Galilee that is occasionally mentioned in the Old Testament. For example, we read of the region of Galilee in Joshua 20 verse 7, Joshua 21, 32, 1 Kings 9, 11, 2 Kings 15, 29, 1 Chronicles 6 verse 76, and in Isaiah 9 and 1. And there aren't many more references to Galilee in the Old Testament. So we have two bodies of water considered here, the Mediterranean Sea, the Sea of Galilee, and then another big marker toned in there would have been the Jordan River. Whenever we think of Israel, and we think of a river, then we think of the Jordan, because it is the main river of Israel. And it's constantly referred to in the Bible. The Jordan flows from Mount Hermon, up in the far north, down through what is now a largely drained Lake Huron, and through the Sea of Galilee, and it empties itself, this Jordan River, eventually into the Dead Sea. Now, it is only 75 miles long, as the crow flies, from Lake Huron in the north down to the Dead Sea. It's 65 miles from the Lake of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. But then the River Jordan is winding and meandering all over its banks, so that if you were to measure it in terms of all the curves and twists in it, it would be more than twice this length. The name Jordan means descender, and appropriately it flows through the deepest rift valley on the face of the earth. Lake Huron is 230 feet or 71 meters above sea level, but then after coming down from Lake Huron, the Jordan dips into Lake Galilee, and Lake Galilee is almost, as we have said, 700 feet, 215 meters below sea level, and it hasn't finished yet. It's still going down as Jordan moves towards the south of the country, and when it comes to the top of the Dead Sea, we have dropped to 1,290 feet below sea level, 397 meters. So Jordan is dipping all the way from north right down to the south of the country. Many people are surprised at how much history has revolved around such a small, and by many standards it is a very small, river. For example, Joshua led the people of Israel across the Jordan from the east into the promised land near Jericho in Joshua chapter 3. During the days of Absalom's rebellion, David escaped across the Jordan to take refuge, 2 Samuel 17, verses 20 to 22. We find that in the days of Elijah and Elisha, they both crossed over the Jordan before Elijah was taken up into heaven, 2 Kings 2, the verses 6 to 8, verses 13 and 14 as well. Then, of course, we have that famous episode with the Syrian general Naaman. He was told by Elisha, God's prophet, to wash in the waters of the Jordan. And he turned up his nose at those waters and he said, "Oh, we have better rivers up in our country in Syria, Abana and Farfar, much cleaner, far better than this lowly Jordan." So he wasn't impressed. And 2 Kings chapter 5 makes that very clear. But a lot of activity in the Old Testament is centering on the river Jordan. Then the fourth main body of water is the Dead Sea. So we're moving downwards here. We began with the Sea of Galilee. We began actually with the Mediterranean Sea out over there to the west. We moved up north to the Sea of Galilee, then followed the Jordan River running through that Sea of Galilee and towards the south into body of water number four, which is the Dead Sea. You'll notice on this map, and you'll see it on a bigger scale map later on in the notes tonight, that the Dead Sea is shaped like a giant hot dog with a bite out of its lower third here. It lies at the bottom of the world. The Dead Sea is actually the lowest point on earth. So if you're ever in the Dead Sea, you can't really get any lower than this in terms of being on the earth. It is the lowest point on earth, almost 3,000 feet below sea level at its lowest point. It begins 1,290 feet below sea level at its northern end, but it keeps on going down until it gets to 3,000 feet below sea level. So water flows into it, but no water ever flows out of the Dead Sea. As a result of that, the water has developed very high mineral deposits. It does not, of course, support animal or plant life, or at least not normal plant or animal life. 30% of the water you'll find to be magnesium, sodium, calcium, potassium chloride, other salts. It's the highest mineral content of any body of water in the world. And so you'll have all of these Dead Sea products. If you're going to be into these health products, and these body massages and all the rest of it, they'll give you the mud from the Dead Sea and all of the other minerals that are so characteristic of this area. It's very interesting when you visit the Dead Sea to see that there are mounds gathered around it and also in it as well of crystallized salt formations. They pretty much dot the shoreline. They loom up out of some of the water. They're like eerie sentinels standing guard. Nothing is growing in the immediate area. Animal life, impossible. And so it's named the Dead Sea. The city of Sodom lies at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. Genesis 19, verse 24. On the slopes of Mount Sodom there still stands a pillar or tomb, at least of salt. And a little imagination when you're in the area, and you can quickly conjure up the doom that overcame Lot's wife. Those grey salt rocks, the canyons of the Sodom region, are barren, and they give all the appearance of having been cursed. Then we move over to the fifth major body of water associated with Old Testament times, and that is the Nile River. Perhaps the most famous river in the world. The Nile flows right down through the heart of Egypt, spreads out like so many fingers, and empties into the Mediterranean Sea. The whole of Egypt's economy depended upon the Nile. The fertile valley of the Nile, it was never more than 12 miles to 19 kilometers wide in the upper part of Egypt. On either side of that Nile valley, you had desert. Every year the river flooded its banks in spring, and it left behind a layer of fertile mud. And wherever there was the fertile mud laid down after the river flooded its banks, crops would grow. Wherever the water went, crops would be able to be developed. Too high a flood would have meant destruction, too low a flood, and the country would have been plunged into starvation. Now, you'll never come across, in reading the Authorized Version, you'll never read deny. It's not named in our Old Testament, but it is featured in the dreams of Joseph's Pharaoh in Genesis 41, verses 1 to 36. You'll find it's the Nile River when the Pharaoh, at the time of Moses' birth, ordered his people to drown all the Hebrew male babies in a river. That was the Nile, Exodus 1, to verse 22. Moses was hidden in a basket among the reeds at the river's edge, and that again would have been the River Nile, Exodus 2, the verses 3 to 10. In one of the plagues, and I find this very interesting, in one of the plagues, the water of the Nile was turned into blood. In another plague, frogs came up from the river and spread right across the country. Exodus 7, 17 to 25, Exodus chapter 8, the verses 1 to 15. Now let me break off and just say this. It was appropriate that the first plague should target the Nile River itself, since this river was the very lifeline of Egypt and the centre of many of its religious ideas. The Egyptians looked upon the River Nile and they thought it was sacred. Many of their gods, and they had lots of gods, a whole pantheon of gods, many of their gods were associated, either directly or indirectly, with this River Nile and its fertility and productivity. For example, they had a god, they referred to him as the great Khnum, who was considered to be the guardian of the Nile sources. Hapi was another Egyptian god, believed to be the spirit of the Nile and its dynamic essence. One of the greatest gods they had, revered in the land of Egypt, was Osiris, who was the god of the underworld, according to them. And the Egyptians believed that this god Osiris had the Nile as his bloodstream. Is that not interesting then, in light of these facts? That the Lord Jehovah should turn the Nile into blood, and those Egyptian gods who were meant to be defending it, who were meant to have it in one case as their own bloodstream, were not able to stop God. The Bible not only says the fish in the river died when this plague hit, but the river stank and the Egyptians were not able to use its water. Crocodiles would have been forced to leave the Nile. What then would the worshippers have thought of Hapi, the god of the Nile, who was sometimes pictured in drawings as a crocodile? God had defeated him and delivered a very crucial blow to the whole economy of Egypt at this time. Just by flexing his muscle for a moment, he showed them that he could bring the entire country to a standstill. That's what that first plague was all about. The Nile is often mentioned by the prophets, Isaiah 18, verse 2, for example, and usually when we find it in the Bible, it's called the River of Egypt, Genesis 15, 18, Numbers 34, 5, Joshua 15, verses 4 and 47, 1 Kings 8, verse 65, 2 Kings 24 and 7, 2 Chronicles 7, and the verse 8. I am not expecting you, by the way, to be turning up these Bible references. Otherwise, Billy Whiz would be eating his heart out, and you'd be able to beat him if you were going at that kind of speed. I'm just throwing them out for the record. So the bodies of water, Mediterranean Sea, Sea of Galilee up there in the north, joined by the Jordan River to the Dead Sea. And then when we move away down into the southwest, we are in the land of Egypt, and we have been looking at the River Nile. Now we're looking at two rivers that in the Bible are often spoken of together, and that's the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. These twin rivers, I suppose we could call them, flow for almost 1,000 miles before they join, and then they deposit themselves down into the Persian Gulf. The Tigris is the second great river of Mesopotamia. It rises in the mountains of Turkey, flows from more than 1,400 miles, joins the Euphrates 40 miles from its mouth on the Persian Gulf. The famous Assyrian cities that we read of in the Bible, Nineveh, for example. And Nineveh now is a city that's in Iraq. A lot of Bible towns are in Iraq, and we'll talk about that a little more slightly further on. But Nineveh, which is now Mosul in Iraq, it was based upon the river Tigris. We have Kala, we have Ishurm. They were other cities that were built on the banks of the Tigris. And the Bible mentions this river Tigris as one of four rivers that came out of the Garden of Eden. But there in Genesis 2 and the verse 14, it goes under the name Hiddekel. So when you read the name Hiddekel in the Bible, you're talking about the river Tigris. In Daniel 10, the verse 4, you'll read about it there as well. So Tigris, and then almost its twin, the river Euphrates. In the Old Testament, this great river Euphrates is simply referred to as the river. Genesis 2:14, Genesis 15:18. Revelation 9:14, Revelation 16, and the verse 12, the Euphrates is in view. It was 1,200 miles long. Rises in eastern Turkey, flows southeast into the Persian Gulf, as did the river Tigris or Hiddekel. Its course, Euphrates' course, through the Babylonian plains, it has moved west over the centuries of time. And it has left, by moving west, it has left many of those ancient cities that once stood on the banks of the Euphrates, now 3 or 4 miles over to the east. The Euphrates has moved that far in places. It's mentioned as one of the four rivers in Eden. Then we come to the final body of water, which is the Persian Gulf, that the Tigris, River Hiddekel, and the Euphrates empty into. The Tigris, the Euphrates, the Persian Gulf form the most easterly boundary for the lands of the Old Testament. The Tigris and Euphrates, they flow through present-day Iraq, while the Persian Gulf separates Iran from Saudi Arabia. So we've talked about these eight main bodies of water that we come across when we are reading through our Old Testament. Now we move on to think of locations. And if you look at the map for a moment, in page 10, the map on page 10 has a number of letters on it. A right through to G are mentioned. And then if you flick back to the bottom of page 4, and you'll see we're starting off at A. And then there's B as well, at the bottom of page 4. And as we move through the notes, we'll get right as far as G, which would be Persia. But beginning at A, we have the Garden of Eden. We've drawn in the outline structure here. We've got the geographical framework when we've got the bodies of water that are put in. Now we can look at locations that are most relevant to the Old Testament history. A is the Garden of Eden. And you might like to flick from page 4 to page 10 again and look at the map and see just whereabouts Eden would most likely have been. The exact location of the Garden of Eden, where everything began, is impossible to pinpoint. However, it was near the place where the four great rivers converge that we read off in Genesis 2, the verses 8 to 14, and two of those four rivers mentioned there were the Tigris and the Euphrates. And so we therefore have positioned Eden, as we believe it is, as it was, in its general location, just where the river Hiddekel and the river Euphrates begin to pour out into the Persian Gulf. So where letter A is positioned on the map. I'm sure you all have heard the speech by Colonel Tim Collins. He gave a very memorable speech to around 800 men of the battle group of the 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Regiment. That would have been part of the 16 Air Assault Brigade. He delivered that speech at Fort Blair Meehan Camp out in the Kuwaiti Desert, about 20 miles from the Iraqi border, on Wednesday the 19th of March 2003. That speech has been written down by a journalist in shorthand. Only one version of it exists. There's no recording of it, no film of it, and so it can't really be corrupted or changed that much, and that's why it has lasted pretty much intact until this day. But one thing they said, that army colonel, really interested me. As he was leading his forces into Iraq, he said, "Iraq is steeped in history. It is the site of the Garden of Eden, of the great flood, and the birthplace of Abraham. Tread lightly here." That's our first location tonight then, the Garden of Eden, the place of the convergence of these two great rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris. But then we'll think of the most important land in the Bible, that's Canaan, or Israel, or Palestine, and it's marked B on the map. This little piece of real estate, it lies between, on the one side, the Mediterranean coast, and on the other, the Sea of Galilee, and the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea, the land of Israel. It actually changes names throughout the Old Testament. In Genesis, the land is called Canaan. After the Hebrew people established themselves in the land, in the book of Joshua, the land becomes known as Israel. 800 years later, at the beginning of the New Testament, it is called Palestine. All the one place, Canaan, Israel, Palestine. What about the geography of Israel? Well, in terms of the size of the country, the land of Israel is very small. Its length from north to south, and we read of those measurements in the Word of God when it talks about from Dan onto Beersheba. What does it mean when they talk about everybody, for example, from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was ordained to be a prophet of the Lord? Well, what the writer is saying there is, from the highest town, the most northerly town up in the north of our country, Dan, to the most southerly spot, which is Beersheba, the whole length of the land, everybody knew this fact. Samuel was God's prophet. And from Dan to Beersheba, it's less than 150 miles, barely 230 kilometers long. If we talk about the size of the land in terms of its width, well, the northern part of the Dead Sea, it's only 50 miles, 80 kilometers, from the coast, from the Mediterranean. So it's quite narrow, 50 miles wide. Stretches a bit when you get towards the southern part of the Dead Sea and then over to the Mediterranean, but it's not a wide country. It's very small, in fact, when you take the whole land of Israel into consideration. Let's draw a comparison. It is slightly larger, all of this land of Canaan, Israel, Palestine, it is slightly larger than the state of New Jersey. Oh, well, hold on, I've never been to New Jersey. I don't know how large or how small New Jersey is. Well, take another comparison. The land of Israel is not even twice the size of Northern Ireland. It is almost twice, but not quite twice the size of Northern Ireland. So we're talking about a small country. The shape of the country, well, Israel is shaped like the roof of a house. That is, when you're over at the Mediterranean to the west, it rises gently from the Mediterranean up until 3,200 feet, 1,000 metres above sea level, and then it plunges down steeply into the great Jordan Rift Valley, where the River Jordan flows. There at the Jordan Rift Valley, where the River Jordan is flowing, the earth's surface has cracked, dropped down to form a trench. And you can trace that trench south all the way down into East Africa. East of the River Jordan and north of Galilee, the mountains begin to rise to even higher heights. And so you'll hear about the Golan Heights, for example, up there where Mount Hermon is, and Lebanon up in the north there. And then over in the eastern part, you'll find the country of Edom, big mountainous region as well. But because of the shape of the land of Israel, going up like the roof of the heights, big mountain range down the middle, as far as surrounding nations were concerned, they looked in at Israel and they thought, the people of Israel in their land, they're just a pile of hill tribes. Hillbillies, I suppose they would call them nowadays. And, you know, you find that in 1 Kings chapter 20, the verse 23. What does King Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, what does his officials say when they're talking about the people of Israel? They say, their gods are gods of the hills. In other words, these people are concentrated in the mountains. And it's true. The heart of the kingdom of Israel lay along the mountain spine between the coast and the Jordan Rift Valley. In these mountains, they could hold off the attacks of the Philistines on the coast. But the Israelites didn't really ever conquer the coastlands. From time to time, maybe under King David, and especially under King David, in fact, they would have expanded north into Syria, or they'd have gone east beyond the River Jordan, when at different times they took control of Moab and they took control of Edom, but their first base and their last base was the Judean hills, right down the centre of their country. That's a bit about the geography of Israel. What about the geology or the rocks in Israel? And again, this is important, believe it or not, when we come to understand the Bible and big Bible events. Geography is important. But we're talking about geology or rock structure and formation here. Limestones or chalks occupy a large part of the surface in Israel. And so with all of this limestone and all of this chalk, you've got your usual, your characteristic landscape features that are associated whenever limestones occur. Water sinks through the limestone. They're permeable. There's little surface drainage. But they usually develop underground streams, and the water can be tapped into by sinking wells. Did you ever ask yourself when you read through the Old Testament, there's a lot of caves here. Why do we read of a lot of caves in the land of Israel? Because limestone contains many caves. It's a typical kind of rock to get large cave structures in. And so in Genesis 49, verses 27 to 32, we read about the cave of Machpelah, for example, that Abraham purchased, and it became a family burying plot. We read in Joshua 10 to verse 32 about kings that Joshua was pursuing, and they all took refuge in a cave. Must have been a big cave. Well, it would have been a big limestone cave, so typical of the country. We read of David taking refuge in 1 Samuel 22 in the verse 1 in the cave of Adullam. We read tonight in 1 Samuel 24, the verses 3 to 8, of a cave where Saul and his men were sleeping, and round the walls of the cave it was so large as to accommodate David. And his band of soldiers, they were still in that same network of caves. In 1 Kings chapter 18, we catch up with the prophet Obadiah, who kept 100 prophets safely in a cave whenever the reign of wicked Ahab and Jezebel was going on, and those prophets would have been persecuted. We read in 1 Kings chapter 19 about Elijah the prophet, and he flees from Jezebel. Where does he end up? He ends up in a cave. Why so many caves? Because it's typical of the landscape. It's a limestone landscape, and you get lots of caves in this kind of landscape. On the surface, limestones often develop a kind of stony pavement. It makes cultivation difficult. It yields only a patchy soil. And all these features, they are found in the hills of Palestine, and they're worked into and figure in the Bible story. We've also got a desert climate in Israel, and that has its effects upon the landscape and upon the structures that we see. In the desert, regardless of rock type, there's usually your surface covering of sand or flintstone or salt, and much of the southern part of the land would have been covered by these infertile deposits. Wind and water were the forces that shaped the desert rock. The wind would have come in and scoured those desert rocks into fantastic shapes. The force of water made all the more powerful and dramatic, because that water is so rare, it would have gouged out steep-sided valleys and overhanging crags, and occasionally flash floods could fill a dry valley several meters deep with water in a few minutes. Now we want to divide the land of Israel up into seven sections. And so we're on page 6, and you'll see about one third of the way down in page 6, the word sections, seven major natural divisions. And they tie in with the little map that's over in page 7, numbered 1 through to 7 on the map. So we're going to look at seven major natural divisions in the land of Israel. Number one, underneath Jerusalem there, or underneath the word Jerusalem, that's the central highlands. That's the peak of the roof that we've been talking about. The peak of that roof, the core area of the Jewish kingdom, lay in the hill country, along the watershed with that land sloping away to the coast, the Mediterranean on the one side, and away down to the Jordan Valley on the other side. The highland, we have said, it rises to just over 3,280 feet at its highest point, up near the town of Hebron. The western slope going towards the Mediterranean is gentle, the eastern slope is very abrupt. Now, what do you have in those highlands, with steep drops down to Jordan, would have been fortified towns. Attack us, if you dare. This hill country made good defence points. And you'll find that the capitals of the northern kingdom of Israel and of the southern kingdom of Judah, both of their capitals would have been up in this hilly area. Of course, put your capital city in a place where it's going to be difficult to get at, where it's going to be nearly impregnable, and where it can defend itself against attack. So down in Judah, the capital city, Jerusalem, in the hill country. Up in Israel, the capital city, Samaria, in this hill country as well. But then if we move out to number two on this little map, we'll find that we're on the plain of Esdraelon. It's also known in the Bible as the Valley of Jezreel. And the Valley of Jezreel, Jezreel means God sows. It's a rough, triangular area, a plain. So the mountains have just dipped down and left a large triangle about 15 miles each side of the triangle. Now it used to be, originally, the floor of the valley there would have been marshy. And it was here in Judges 4:15 that Sisera lost his chariots and had to escape on foot because the chariot wheels got stuck in this valley floor. But it has been drained. And today it forms the most fertile agricultural area in the modern state of Israel. So when we hear today about the valley blossoming as the rose, we are talking about this plain of Esdraelon, or the valley of Jezreel, or otherwise it is known by the name of Armageddon. Yes, Armageddon is here. It's always been of great strategic importance, this area. It was on the principal route, if you were travelling from south to north or north to south, it was on the main trade route in the ancient world. The Romans would have gone through this valley, others would have gone through the valley, the Egyptians, etc. They'd have called it in Roman times the Via Maris, the way of the sea, and they'd have cut through it on the way from Egypt to Damascus and further on to Mesopotamia. It was an obvious route for trade, an obvious place for invasion. And that might account for the long list of battles that have been fought in this plain. Right up to the modern times, to the Israeli War of Independence in 1948, the major battle was fought here, at number two on your map, the Valley of Jezreel. But back in the days of Gideon, Old Testament, he fought against the Midianites and the Amalekites here. Judges 6:33 through to Judges 7:23. Solomon built a city here and fortified it. Megiddo, he called it. That would have been his chariot city. And the chariots would have been brilliant right across the plains. That's why he had the city there. 1 Kings 9:15. If he was going to fight, it'll be fought in the plains, the Valley of Jezreel. That's why the chariot city Megiddo was there. And we have also Jehu's army coming in and defeating Jezebel in 2 Kings chapter 9 here in the Valley of Jezreel. We find that King Joash, the king of Judah, was killed when he was trying to block off the Egyptians who were coming up from the south, trying to go through and help in a battle involving Assyria and Babylon. And Josiah tried to cut the Egyptians off, but was killed himself, 2 Kings 23, the verse 29. So there's two of the seven major natural divisions in the country, the central highlands, the mountains running right down from number one there, right into the south. We have number two, the plain of the Valley of Jezreel. We have number three, the region of Galilee. Its upland ranges again in Galilee, stretching on into the north, where you've got the high mountains of Lebanon coming in. And so you've got the buffer zone in real time today between Israel and Syria, and then through into Lebanon. You've got the Golan Heights, and further into Lebanon, you've got those Lebanese mountains. It's the region of Galilee that we're talking about here. This was always a place, even in Old Testament times, where foreign influences would have been the strongest. The great trade routes passed through here, brought along many strangers with it, put the land in touch with the outside world, made it aware of non-Jewish ideas. All of the foreign influence would have been concentrated up there in the Galilee. And so the Israelites seldom had it under total control. Then we're thinking about the coastal plain number 4. That's going out towards the Mediterranean coast. When Israel occupied the Promised Land, they captured the central highlands. They made an attempt here and an attempt there and another attempt again to spread their control down the slope to the Mediterranean coast. But on that Mediterranean coast, an enemy of Israel lived, the Philistines. We read about them all through the book of Judges. Rose up in the days of Samuel, rose up in the days of Samson, rose up in countless occasions through history. The Philistines were a real nuisance to Israel. Now, under David, Israel was able to gain control of the Philistine territories for a while, but more often than not, in Israel's history, the Philistines were exerting pressure, coming in, stealing the harvests, attacking the borders of Israel, exerting pressure from their 5 cities on the coastlands up right into the hills of Israel. The coastlands weren't at this time a very attractive area. You'd have gone there, you'd have found coastal sand dunes backed by forests, lagoons and swamp. There were no natural harbours to the south of Carmon. The Philistines weren't boat people, seafaring men. They didn't really get into that very much. So the first major port along the coast was the artificial harbour at Caesarea that wasn't built until the days of King Herod the Great, just before Jesus was born. Now, of course, in this place where the Philistines used to be in Old Testament times, you've got the Gaza Strip. And we read a lot and hear a lot about the Gaza Strip today. Israel's enemies are still sitting there on the coastal strip, the way they always have been. Then we've got number 5, Shephelah, or the Piedmont, between the coastlands out of the Mediterranean Sea and the upland, the peak of the roof, the mountains. Between the two, there was an area of lower foothills, used to be covered by forests of sycamores. When the Philistines fought the Israelites, this area of hills, the Shephelah or the Piedmont, number 5, it would have been a kind of no man's land. Philistines would have ventured into it. Then Israel from the other side would have ventured into it. Skirmishes constantly would have taken place. Now, for either side to attack the other and launch a big-scale invasion from the Philistines or from the Israelite side, you had to go through the Shephelah district, the Piedmont region, the no-man's land. Most of the routes then through this area would have been fortified or guarded, and you'll read about this during the days of David and Jonathan. The Jordan Valley is number 6. We're moving our way pretty well through these. You're not going to take half of this material in, don't panic. That's why we're printing it out, and you can at your leisure read it sometime, or you can just put it in your filing cabinet and leave it for some really rainy day. But number 6, the Jordan Valley. We've talked about the River Jordan rising near Mount Hermon, flowing south through the now largely drained Lake Huleh, down into the Sea of Galilee and right on down into the Dead Sea, where it stops, because it doesn't flow out of there again. The Jordan Valley is a geological rift. Its sides are following parallel faults in the earth's crust, and that's why it's sunken down, why the valley is so deep. And we have talked about the depth of it, so we'll not go over that territory again. We'll move to number 7. And number 7 is the land that is east. We're crossing over the Jordan here, the land to the east of the Jordan, called the Trans-Jordan. You've got mountains here, but they're higher than many of the other mountains. It's a well-watered area. When you cross over the Jordan into the land of Moab, into the land of Edom, for example, and you've got good pasture land for the huge flocks of sheep and the herds of cattle that were raised in Moab. Now, it's not without coincidence that we read in 1 Kings chapter 3, the verse 4, about something the king of Moab did. He was under tribute to Israel. He had to pay a colossal tax each year. What was the tax? He paid 100,000 lambs and the wool from 100,000 sheep every year to Israel as tribute. And that tells us something. Well, it tells us just what we have said. You've got good pasture land in Moab here when you cross over the River Jordan. The mountains rise from 1,900 to 2,300 feet. That's just to the east of Galilee, to almost 6,500 feet when you come south and east of the Dead Sea. Large rainfall here increases, of course, with height, makes them a fertile belt between the dry valley on the one side, that's the Jordan River Valley, and the Arabian Desert, which is out on the other side. We read in the Bible of Bashan. We read of Gilead. And they're obviously fertile places, a lot of greenery. This is where they are located. We read of the prosperity of the sheep raisers of Moab, the success of the traders of Edom. And because these people were so successful, had a good agricultural economy, then it made these areas powerful rivals of Israel west of the Jordan. It was maybe just as well for Israel that the Jordan, and the Jordan Valley in particular, made it so difficult for these people to move into the land of Israel from the east. Then we come to area number C. We began, if you remember, with area number A, and that's us going onto the map again on page 10. And area A would have been the Garden of Eden. Then we came to area number B, which is Canaan, or Israel, or Palestine, the same area. Then C. The letter C brings us to the city of Jerusalem. We find Jerusalem, it's located just off the northwestern shoulder of the Dead Sea. Jerusalem is nestled in the mountains, those central mountains in Israel, that spine running up the country. And Jerusalem is so central to the story of the Old Testament that really we have to single it out and we have to identify it here. Jerusalem was the capital of Israel's early kings, later the capital of the southern kingdom of Judah. It has an elevated site, as we have said, some 2,500 feet up in those Judean hills. And if you're in Jerusalem, it's amazing how the ground drops steeply away on three sides, all except the north. On the sides of the north, the city of the great king, do we read of that in Psalm? Psalm 48 and 2, Psalm 122 and 3, Psalm 125 and 2. Jerusalem is on the hill. It's surrounded by valleys. The Kidron Valley lies to the east. The Valley of Hinnom, the rubbish dump of the place, curves around the south and to the west of the city. Then there's a third central valley that cuts right into the city, that divides the Temple area and the city of David from the upper western section of the city of Jerusalem. I think we're first introduced to Jerusalem back in Genesis 14, to verse 18, when we have Melchizedek reigning in Abraham's day. And I believe he was reigning over Jerusalem, which back then was called Salem. He was the king of Salem, which is the king of peace, most likely Jerusalem. It was in the days of David, a Jebusite stronghold. David captured it, made it his capital in 2 Samuel chapter 5, and there's a big story behind how he was able to capture the city of Jebus. The people, the Jebusites, felt it will never be taken. We reign supreme. Our city will never fall. But David, by an ingenious method, captured the city. We'll talk about that some other time. David bought the temple site. He brought the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem, 2 Samuel 24, verses 18 to 25, 1 Chronicles 21, 18 to 13, and 1 Chronicles 22, the verse 1. Then after David, his son Solomon built the temple here on the ground that King David, his father, had bought, 1 Kings, the chapter 6. Now to some extent, after the days of Solomon, the city of Jerusalem declined. When the kingdom divided into north and into south, the city declined again. In the reign of King Hezekiah, Jerusalem was attacked and laid siege to by the Assyrians. Given the fact I've spent all of my ministry to date in Londonderry or Derry, and because it has such a familiar setting with the siege back in 1689-1688, then sieges ring a bell with me, and I tend to explore them and read about them a little more than probably I would other things. But in the reign of King Hezekiah, Jerusalem had a siege. The Assyrians were all around it. And the King Hezekiah had the tunnel of Siloam built that has been discovered. And he ensured a water supply into the city through building this tunnel of Siloam. 2 Kings 18, verse 13 through to 19, verse 36, and 2 Kings 20, the verse 20. Then later on in its history, Jerusalem was besieged again, this time by the Babylonians, 597 BC. And in 586 BC, they captured and destroyed the city and the temple. And that's why in the book of Lamentations, Jeremiah is lying among the rubble of Jerusalem. And he is crying, he is lamenting about this city that lay dear to his heart, Jerusalem, that had been defeated now, destroyed and burned and pillaged by the Babylonians. The people were taken away into exile in Babylon. That's where Daniel comes in, that's where Ezekiel comes in. And it was 538 BC before the people were ever allowed to return. 70 years of captivity. They came back under the leadership of Zerubbabel. They rebuilt the temple when they came back, Ezra chapter 5, and they rebuilt the walls. And that's what the book of Nehemiah is all about, the building up of the walls of the city of Jerusalem when they come back from captivity. In 198 BC, Jerusalem came under the control of the Greek Empire. Then, for a time, it was free because it got deliverance from them. But in the middle of the 1st century BC, the Romans took control. So, you can see what the pattern is here. It's being attacked, and attacked, and attacked, and attacked again. Under the Romans, Herod the Great was made king by the Romans. He was a Jew himself, but he was made king by the Romans. Loyal to them. He repaired Jerusalem. He started a lot of new building projects. He built up a magnificent new temple, which would be the third temple now on the site. We had Solomon's temple, we had Zerubbabel's temple, a more modest structure, of course, than Solomon's, because he didn't have the wherewithal and the materials and the money to build a really sparkling edifice in the days of Zerubbabel when he'd just come back from captivity. And then Herod's temple, the temple that Jesus would have been standing and walking through, that would have been the third temple on the same site. After Christ, AD 70, Romans came again, regained the city, crushed the Jewish rebellion, destroyed the defences, and brought the temple down, so there's only one wall remains of that temple today. In AD 637, Muslims took control of Jerusalem. Jerusalem remained under Muslim control until 1948. From 637 through to 1948, when the modern state of Israel came into being, Jerusalem then was carved up, divided between the Jews and the Arabs. But of course in 1967, the Jews won control of the entire city, and it's still a big bone of contention, even to this day. We'll move on quickly to Egypt. We've talked about Egypt, bottom of page 9 in the notes, being a centre of ancient civilization, plays a central role in the history of the Old Testament. We've got three main periods of greatness that Egypt rose to. Its Pyramid Age, the Middle Kingdom, when Abraham probably visited Egypt because of the famine in Canaan, and then we have Joseph coming into the picture there as well, and then a third big period of Egyptian history would have been the Empire period, 1500 to 1070 BC. A new royal city was built called Pi Ramesses. You can read about it in Exodus 12, 37, Numbers 33, 3 and 5. That would have been the time when the Hebrew children were being oppressed under the Egyptian slave and taskmasters, made to construct bricks without straw and all of that. And Moses is sent to lead Israel, the Hebrew people, out of Egypt. Then we come to Assyria. Assyria, you'll see on the map there, is number E. It's located at the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. A great world power it was, this Assyrian nation, notable in the Old Testament for conquering the northern kingdom of Israel and scattering her people to the four winds of the heaven. Chief cities for Assyria would have been Asher, the capital, Nineveh, and you'll read about Nineveh in the days of Nahum, and you'll read even more about Nineveh in the days of Jonah. That's where Jonah was sent to, Nineveh, that great city the capital of the Assyrian Empire, and it's now in Mosul in Iraq. The Assyrians were fierce soldiers. They captured Israel, 2 Kings 17, 5-41. And there's more data there in the notes, but we'll not mention it here at this moment in time. We come to Earth, which is Babylonia. It was another gigantic historical world power, but it didn't really reign for very long. But while it did reign, it conquered the southern kingdom of Judah, 150 years after Assyria had conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. You'll find Babylonia in Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and the Euphrates, and you'll find it again in the land of Iraq. Iraq is so central. Bible towns and cities. Mesopotamia, by the way, means in the middle of the rivers. Meso, in the middle of rivers, Potamus. And that's where you see Mesopotamia, lettered F here on the map, in the middle of the rivers. The two great rivers we began with, Euphrates and the Tigris. Then G, the final spot, Persia. You remember how you had the king Belshazzar? He's in his feast in Daniel chapter 5, but then he's conquered. He's defeated. The kingdom falls into the hands of who? The Medes and the Persians. Where did he come from? Where G is on your map. Persia. It was the final historical superpower of Old Testament times. You'll find it there, as you see in the map, on the north bank of the Persian Gulf. Persia comes into play here then by conquering Babylon, by allowing the Hebrews to return from captivity in Babylon and rebuild the city of Jerusalem and reinstate the temple worship. Now, you've been going through all of this material, beginning with these eight bodies of water, Mediterranean Sea, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, Nile River, Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and the Persian Gulf, moving through to main locations, the Garden of Eden, the land of Canaan, or Israel, and Palestine, then through into the city of Jerusalem, the major centre in all of that land, then moving from Jerusalem, he came to Egypt, and Assyria, and Babylon, and Persia. If all of these names just thrown at you as they have been in double quick time, if they're all foreign, don't worry about it now. Just learn where the locations are, the main locations on the map, so that as the story in the Bible unfolds, the names of these locations will mean something.